Welcome to the Viscast, everybody. We are still in Holy Week, and this episode is one that I'm kind of excited about. We focused mostly on the major players involved at the end of Jesus' life. So from, say, the Passover meal until his crucifixion, what's happening exactly? What's motivating these people? Why does Judas betray Jesus? And what is he telling the chief priests exactly? The chief priests, what's their motivation? Why do they want to seemingly put an end to Jesus's movement? And Pilate, what does he need to hear in order to be convinced to put Jesus to death? And what do we know about Pilate from outside of the gospel accounts? So, it's speculative in a way, but it's informed speculation. And I think we delve into some really interesting new ideas about what's happening with these major players at the end of Jesus' life. So I hope you'll give it a shot and consider some of the things we talk about. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll be back with some more episodes on Holy Week. One of the things that I've been thinking about more recently, over the last 5 or 6 years or so, is exactly what Judas's role was in the end of Jesus's life. Obviously, we know that he's identified as the one who betrayed Jesus, but the question might be, what did he exactly betray? What information did he give to the authorities that helped lead to Jesus's arrest and, I would say, ultimately, even his death? I think that traditionally I thought about Judas as just having given the location of Jesus, because the text kind of suggests that that was Judas's role. You know, the crowds, to some degree or another, were enchanted by Jesus and his message. So you have a few times at the end of Jesus's life, the texts say that the chief priests wanted to arrest Jesus, but they were afraid of the crowds, so they didn't do it then. And that would lead you to believe then that this night arrest on Passover, on the first day of Passover, the main day of Passover, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread follows, so the holiday continues, they arrest Jesus. And my assumption always was, well, Judas betrayed where they hung out in the evenings and where they slept. But I've come to think that that's kind of too small of a role for what's happening here. Partially because I just assume that if for many days they've been wanting to arrest Jesus, well, they could have just kind of sent somebody to surveil him and figured out where he slept. I mean, the text seems to indicate they would go back sort of to the Mount of Olives area, maybe to Bethany, to sleep. And somebody could have just followed them and gotten a pretty good idea of where that is. But still, that might have been part of Judas's role. But I've been thinking more of imagining an expanded role for Judas in the betrayal. And my main thought is that he's giving them intel about Jesus, because they've only known, or most likely only known, about Jesus and his teachings based on what he's said over the last few days in the temple area. But Judas has been with him for some time and knows more about what Jesus has been saying and teaching, and can give them more intel about Jesus and his message. And the type of thing that they might be looking for, sort of moving forward to think about the cross, is they need a reason to give to Pilate for Pilate to agree to ultimately have Jesus executed. And what they're looking for, I would say, is something hinting at insurrection. Something Jesus is saying that the state, in this case Rome, would be bothered by. So that might be what Judas is providing. Something of saying, yeah, he's saying things that are undermining, or that could possibly undermine Roman rule in Judea. He here are some of the things that he has said, that then the chief priests, or maybe just the chief priests, can use when ultimately the chief priest needs to bring Jesus to Pilate if the chief priest is wanting Jesus dead. He has to bring something, bring Jesus and some charge to Pilate.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I mean, thank you again for that kind of thinking outside the box, you know, asking the right questions. I think that's the one thing I appreciate most about you. I didn't so much when you were little, but I appreciate it more and more as our father-son relationship has become a friendship and a reverse mentoring, where you are mentoring me as much, if not more, than the other way around. So thank you for asking that question, because when you started asking it a few years ago, and I remember exactly when that started on one of our trips, I've been thinking about that too. You know, what exactly did Judas do to make him so hated and despised and ultimately blamed for so much, right? And part of that might be just to the disciples trying to find a scapegoat rather than have to own up to their own role in this. And 'cause I do that, and I think a lot of us do that. So I think, you know, that's a part of it. I mean, they all played a role in this at the end, and we're going to talk more about that. But, you know, centering on Judas, one of the things I remember reading some time ago was that Judas and Jesus were the ones who understood that Jesus was using Judas to help him manufacture his own death. You know, that goes to the need to have Jesus orchestrating this. And I know you've heard that one. We've all heard that one, that Jesus orchestrated his own death because he needed to die to save us from our sins. He did this. He didn't. I mean, I had a friend just the other day when we were talking about something about this planning at church, somebody I work with at church, who said, well, yeah, but Jesus was planning this all along. And I thought, I didn't say it because I wasn't up for an argument, but I thought, no, I don't think so, but okay. But I think that's part of the theory about Joseph, that Judas, so that when Jesus says to Judas, go do what you have to do, Jesus is releasing Judas to do what they'd had planned, which was to give. So I don't buy that at all, by the way, not at all. But that's one of the prevailing theories that I've heard try to explain Judas and Jesus and their role. Another one that I've heard in terms of Judas' role is that Judas is increasingly becoming uncomfortable with Jesus' teaching. And then when Jesus cleanses the temple and Judas sees this as a challenge to the temple or to the temple authorities, that's when Judas has his breaking point and then goes to the high priest and agrees to work with them, to conspire with them, to engineer, in a sense, Jesus' demise.
Yeah, I think the secondary question that you're getting at is, if Judas's role was to conspire with the chief priests in order to have Jesus arrested, and it may be that Judas didn't think this would lead to Jesus's death, because that is that's a pretty severe punishment for ultimately whatever it is the chief priests are upset about. You know, that's going to the ultimate punishment. He might have thought, and Pilate suggests this, that it would just lead to flogging, and maybe Jesus would be sort of reprimanded and would stop. But behind that is, what was it that Jesus said or did that led to Judas deciding you know, I've had enough of this. I'm not on board anymore with what this movement is doing. And so Judas is deciding, I'm going to put an end to this. The question is, what end did Judas think he was putting? Did he think Jesus would just be reprimanded slightly, maybe flogged, and that would lead to the end of it? And then also, what exactly happened? You pointed to the possibility of the temple incident. I think that could be. Sort of two other possibilities exist, if you're willing to mess with the time frame a little bit. There is the anointing by a woman, and that has a dual connotation. Is he being anointed as the coming king or for his death? In the text, we have Jesus saying, well, you think, you know, perhaps they're thinking it's anointing as a king or a prophet, but actually she's anointing me for my burial. It may be also the actually the Last Supper, in which we talked about the last episode, in which Jesus does this quite bizarre ritual about ingesting his body and blood. And you can imagine, I at least can imagine, in any of the disciples being there and thinking, that's enough for me. This is out of hand. We don't really know. I think it's interesting speculation, though, because it humanizes everything that's happening. We have a tendency to theologize everything that's happening. And I would say even the gospel writers have a way of doing that. It's not really on us. They do that often too. For example, Luke says that Satan enters Judas and Judas goes on and does his terrible things. So that's a way of theologizing what Judas chooses to do, which I'm not particularly fond of, probably because I'm not particularly fond of that theological overlay to sort of the universe that we're living in, a universe in which it's a tug of war between these supernatural forces of evil and these supernatural forces of good. I don't conceptualize the world in that way. So then when I look back on these events, I'd rather conceptualize or try to think of them in human terms. And I could imagine at some point Judas saying, this is not what I signed up for. This is getting too odd. This is problematic enough. Maybe if I go to the chief priest, they can help facilitate putting an end to this kind of very odd movement that I became a part of. I mean, if not to put too fine a point on it, but imagine being in a cult and at some point just having this moment where you say, what have I gotten myself into here? This has gotten really strange. I gotta do something. And imagining that you then see the other people who are your friends in the cult and saying, like, I got to find a way to just kind of get everybody out of this mess, maybe even including the leader, because this is getting out of hand. I realize that analogy is extremely challenging because we're talking about Jesus and his movement as a cult, but I'm trying as hard as I can to get us to sympathize with whatever it is was happening with Judas that led him to do this thing. And I think if you're willing, you can find, I think, decent explanations for why Judas went down this path. And I think it has to do somewhat with some of the things Jesus was doing and saying that were either too far outside of the box, or in some ways just kind of letting them all down by saying, oh, this kingdom isn't going to happen. Actually, I'm going to die. All of that was just very, for the disciples, very disappointing and jarring, I think. So he goes to the chief priest, and then I think the next thing I wanted to talk about, and then I'll let you start in case there's something you want to say about Judas, but what is the role, do we think, of the chief priests or of the Sanhedrin here at the end of Jesus's life?
Well, I'll just comment about your statement about that. I love the example of a cult. I think that's exactly right. I think what Jesus and his movement was a cult. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with using that word in its technical sense as the way you meant it. And by the way, when people get all bent out of shape over using these kind of words, I want to say, come on, you know, give that some thought. You know, churches can be cults, personality driven. And I know churches that have become like that, very successful churches. And we just had a case where a very prominent pastor got himself in some trouble, and the elders of that church couldn't come to criticize him until it was just became clear that what he did was out of bounds. That's a cult. That's cultic behavior. And it's not, I think using it in this sense is perfect, actually. So I want to, what I want to do to wrap up my thing about Judas is, I think it's interesting that if we can trust the Gospels, and, you know, I certainly try hard, I know you do too, Judas had second thoughts. And I think it also could have been about money for Judas. 30 pieces of silver would have been a pretty good amount of money. And I have no problem thinking it was greed as a part of it. He got paid pretty good. Now he went back according to the text and threw the money, and they used the money to buy Potter's Field after he hung himself, because it was blood money, right? And all of that. But I think the fact that Judas had second thoughts, and then I'll say one last thing and then turn it back to you, because I'm really interested in where we're going to go with this next one. I know you got some new ideas about this, about the Sanhedrin and the chief priests, is that I'm sorry Judas hung himself or whatever he did. I mean, I'm sorry he did that, because I think if he hadn't, Jesus would have sought him out just the same way he did Peter. And I would have liked to have seen what the results of that have been.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that was an unforgivable sin. Maybe there are no unforgivable sins. On the chief priests, the curiosity around this is, and this is not just me, but it's scholars of the New Testament and of late Second Temple Judaism, is that two things. The idea that the full Sanhedrin, right, this group of significant Jewish leaders, they would have been, some of them would have been like the chief priests and other priests, but also Pharisees were a part of the Sanhedrin, we know. But these would have been significant leaders, and most likely powerful, and most likely rich. That they would have gotten together on the first day of the Passover celebration, you know, sort of in the early hours of that day. The day starts in the evening, so the disciples and Jesus celebrate the Passover once the sun has gone down. Right. And then Judas goes, and then they go to the garden, and then Jesus gets arrested. So this is happening on that principal Passover day. That they would have gotten together on that day is, it just strains credibility, basically. And what's more likely or possible is that just the chief priest or one of the main people of the Sanhedrin was sort of organizing Jesus's arrest, and then organizing with Pilate some sort of punishment for Jesus. Obviously, we know it leads to death, but there is this probably legitimate sort of kernel of truth when Pilate says, you know, I'll just flog him, and that'll be sort of, he'll learn his lesson, and that'll be good enough, hopefully. So I think it's more likely that, yes, the chief priests, probably with some Roman soldiers, arrest Jesus. And then there's maybe some sort of conversation between Jesus and the chief priest. But the idea that we would know what was said there, and then further what it is they took issue with Jesus, that is kind of just a mystery. The conversations we have recorded in the Gospels between, in some cases, the Sanhedrin, in the Gospel of John, just the chief priest, they don't really give very satisfying answers about what it is the, let's say, just the Jewish leadership was upset about with Jesus. Saying you're a Messiah is not blasphemy. We know this about late Second Temple Judaism. There's basically nothing preserved in the text that satisfies the charge of blasphemy. And ultimately, as is shown in the text and known historically, you can't take someone, a Jewish person like Jesus, to Pilate and say, he's blaspheming our religion, please kill him. I mean, Pilate's not going to do that. You need a charge that will stick based on issues that Rome would care about. And then Rome does not care about the particulars of the Jewish religion and a person who is saying things that the chief priests don't like. They need a charge that the state is going to care about. I'll stop there on the chief priests' part. Anything you want to add to that?
Only that chief priests is always interesting to me. How is that plural? So you got Caiaphas and the chief priest. Well, one of the things I've learned through study is that there were many ex-priests who were chief priests at one time, Ananias being one. And so they kept the title. So chief priests, I think it's more likely, I mean, this is a new thought for me, but I've warmed up to it rather quickly, that what you have is, if you had a trial, and I think he probably did, I don't have any reason to think he didn't, it would have been with a handful, and certainly not with the whole Sanhedrin. In fact, it may have been just with Caiaphas, Ananias, and a few other of the ex-chief priests who would have had the largest stake in the financial venture that was the temple. I mean, they were the ones who oversaw this lucrative business that was the temple. And so Jesus, seen as a threat to the temple, would have been to them reason enough to want him either punished or dealt with.
Yeah, I think you have to look for a structural reason for the chief priests, and I think it's perfectly reasonable to think about it, you know, just a handful of power players, to want Jesus in some way punished so that he stops whatever he's doing. And that has to mean more than blasphemy. That doesn't really fit the bill. But speaking out negatively about the temple, that does fit the bill. That's just too important, both religiously, but as you point out, also financially for them, and in some ways for many, many people in Jerusalem. Their livelihood depends on the temple. I mean, if you think about the temple as like this huge complex, which it was, and you have all these people selling and buying things, you know, the commercial enterprise of Judaism, yes, but of Jerusalem, what is Jerusalem without the temple? And if you come and you're starting to undermine that temple complex in some way, yes, you are going to upset many, not just the leaders, but many, many people in Jerusalem. You're going to upset them.
Well, there's, you know, Bernie Sanders, and not to get political here, and this isn't meant to be an endorsement, but Bernie Sanders talks about the military-industrial complex, and he talks about the prison-industrial complex, and I think there's also a religious-industrial complex. In our country today, and I think in Jesus' day, there was a religious-industrial complex. And any challenge you make to that is a challenge to the financial benefits of that to those who are in that complex. And I see the same thing at play today. You know, anyone in Christianity, in the church, who challenges some of these theories or theologies or belief systems that have been with us forever, that we really use as a basis for our whole system, that doesn't play well. And I think Jesus, as an innovator, as a reformer, was doing that, and it didn't play well. It would have affected their pocketbooks. And just as Judas might have done this for as simple a reason as greed, I think it's possible that the chief priests might have done this for exactly the same reason, for as simple a reason as greed. There's a reason that the western side of Jerusalem in the first temple and the second temple period was the wealthy side of town. And who lived there? The priests, who lived down at the bottom by the Pool of Siloam and in the area to by where was Dung Gate. The poor lived down there. Well, how was it that the priests were wealthy? You know, they didn't inherit their money. They made their money on a religious industrial complex, the temple. And Jesus might have been, I think, likely was in some way a challenge to that, or they saw it that way. And in my opinion, that was his chief sin.
Yeah. And
just as it is almost always.
Yeah. Blessed are the poor, right?
Blessed are the poor. And by the way, you know, I told you this earlier when we were talking before is, you know, when I was writing blogs, one of the most read, one of the blogs I was proudest of and the one that was most read was during this time of the year, I wrote Jesus Died for Greed. And I talked about exactly what was happening political in Israel-Palestine at the time and how everybody bought into that. And as much as anything else, it had to do with money, had to do with finances. And I think that was true in Jesus' day, just as it's true today. It's about the money.
Yeah. But you can imagine in that scenario, though, you can imagine the chief priests, even though I don't think what the Gospels give us about his interaction with the chief priests can be seen as historically accurate, because how do you get that information as a writer, right? It's only Jesus and the chief priests. But that they would not want to frame it that way, right? Because this is always the case, even now. Nobody wants to be seen as not caring about regular people, as being an elitist, right? So even though you might be an elitist and you might have policies that favor the elite and the wealthy and big business and the arms industry, you don't want to be seen that way, because you know that's not going to play very well. You find some other reason to say, well, we can't do this because of X. And so I would guess the chief priests probably also wanted at least to be seen as saying there are these other problems we have with Jesus, not because he's risking our most lucrative enterprise. So turning to Pilate, Pilate needs a legitimate state reason to kill Jesus. And it seems pretty clear that reason is available and that ultimately Pilate takes it. And this is where you can just look to what is written on the cross, above Jesus on the cross, and that is King of the Jews. You cannot, or you can, but it's very risky to be saying that you and your movement are going to upend the political system of Rome and start a new kingdom and not put yourself at risk. And my guess is part of what Judas supplies. So he may supply some information about, look, Jesus talks a lot about you know, bringing down the poor and the, I mean, bringing down the rich and the powerful and lifting up the poor. Priests don't want to hear that. And then he also can supply to them. Yeah, and he talks a lot about how there's a coming kingdom that's going to wipe out all the poor, powerful people and replace it with God's good kingdom. And I would say Judas probably said, and he's going to be the king of that new kingdom. And that's good fodder for the priests to bring to Pilate. And like I said, if you look what's written above Jesus on the cross, that ultimately seems to be the information Pilate uses to relent, if that is what happened. We can talk about what we think Pilate was actually like in this whole exchange and have Jesus killed. Just one other thing I'll add before I turn it to you is that it was a distinct possibility that Pilate would also round up some of the most prominent followers of Jesus. So the fear that the disciples, Peter among them, have, and I think this helps you understand Peter's denial, is that not that they don't want to be associated with Jesus in some way, right? That they suddenly are upset about it. No, it's that they feared they would also be rounded up with Jesus and would suffer the same fate as Jesus, because in the past, and they would probably know this, that was how it sometimes went. If the Rome thought, hey, to put this movement down, it's not going to be enough just to kill the leader. We need to kill the main leader and some of his most prominent followers. Rome did that. That was not uncommon at all. And so their fear is not misplaced, is what I want to say.
Absolutely. We ought not romanticize Pilate. I hate that when we do that. And that's not what I heard you doing, but we do it. He's a cosmopolitan man. He was torn, you know, between what to do with Jesus. Pilate was a murderous SOB. He was a brutal man. And he would have had no problem crucifying another young Jew. He wouldn't have lost a moment of sleep over that. I mean, all of that is just an effort to, when the Jesus movement, the temple's destroyed, the Jesus movement runs into conflict with the rabbinic movement, there's this need among Jesus' Jewish followers to distinguish themselves. And so, you know, the Jewish leaders then become the bad guys. And I think they were. In some ways, this wasn't about the Jewish people. Even in the trial account, when they're brought before Pilate, you know, the gospel writers make it clear it's the chief priests and the elders again who are stirring up the people. And if the trial is taking place up in the west side of town, which again most think by where Pilate would have been staying in one of the palaces with Herod, Antipas in the other palace, you know, which makes a lot of sense, and Caiaphas's house, or where Caiaphas lived, is right there, then who would have been the crowd? The crowd wouldn't have been the poor people who live down by the Pool of Siloam. They don't go up to the Western Market to shop. That's not where they go. You know, they have their own areas where they shop even today. That's the same thing is true. So, you know, the chief priests engineered this. They're the ones who stirred up the people on the west side of town who would have been the wealthy people. So, you know, all of that points back to a leadership, you know, need to rid themselves of someone who was troublesome. And Jesus was troublesome. I think that's clear. He was revolutionary. He was apocalyptic. And Pilate would have had no problem. Now, it ought to be mentioned, though, before we move on here, that Luke is still has Jesus talking about an apocalyptic movement on Thursday night. He has Jesus talking about swords. This is in chapter 22 of Luke. And he has them even then. Luke has Jesus saying, you will be sitting on thrones. This is just before he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. He's on his way there when Luke has him saying this. So even on Thursday night, Jesus is talking to the disciples about a kingdom that involves thrones. So we ought not be surprised that the disciples are still confused on Friday, you know, and devastated on Friday when Jesus is crucified and God doesn't intervene, you know. So, I mean, that you know, the way this works out, the way this makes most sense to me, historically speaking, and given all, is that this was primarily done by leadership, Jewish leadership, Roman leadership, and it was simply another Jew who was a problem. And neither one of them had any problems selling out another Jew who was causing problems. And that includes the chief priests.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you pointed something that I think is really interesting to mention and to think about. And that is, and Luke does this explicitly, truly this man was innocent, is what the Roman guard says when Jesus dies. In the other two gospels, it's truly this was God's son. Was Jesus innocent of what he's accused of? Is a really provocative question. If he's being, let's say he's being accused, and I think this is what he's being accused of. He's being accused of saying he is the coming king of the Jewish people. Is that a false accusation? It's not. That's a hard truth. I'm not saying Jesus deserved death, because I don't think he was actually an insurrectionist in the sort of traditional sense. Yes, his disciples had a couple swords, but he never clearly was articulating gathering an army of people that would upend Rome. He thought, as an apocalypticist, that God would intervene on his behalf and do the sort of mop-up operation necessary to end the evil forces, both natural, Rome, and some of the priests are going to be included in that, and supernatural. But if Judas comes and says, yeah, he's saying he's going to be a king in a new kingdom that's coming soon, I would submit to you that Judas is not lying. So often I see people say he was an innocent man falsely accused and killed under false pretenses. I would say he didn't deserve death, but I would also then say the accusation, if it is that he was saying he was the future king in a coming kingdom in which Rome had no place and the current temple had no place, he is not falsely accused. That is exactly, I would submit to you, what he is saying to his disciples. It's part of why they're on board. They want to be a part of the leadership in this new kingdom. Him mentioning thrones here at the end is only reiterating my point. I don't know what to do with that ultimately, except to face it with some honesty by saying, on that count, he is in some respects guilty.
Yeah, and I would say that what it doesn't change is the fact that Friday's act is a hateful act. It's humanity at its worst. It's humanity's best, Jesus, being murdered with humanity at its worst. It's a hateful act. And one thing, too, as we kind of reach for a close here, is before, as we think about the Garden of Gethsemane and what happened there, because I think that's one of the most moving parts of the whole Jesus story is that night. It is for me. I mean, Joshua, I don't know about you, but I've had Garden of Gethsemane moments, moments where I saw what was coming and I knew there was pain involved and it wasn't what I wanted and I didn't understand and I couldn't control it. And I was there and I didn't know that it was, if it was any fault of my own or not, or where to put, but this is where Jesus is at. And I think it's a powerful message that we've all, if you haven't had a Garden of Gethsemane moment, you will. Most of us have more than one. And where we're faced with the fact that we're going to have some pain coming forward. And we're wishing there was another way. And we might even say to God in the midst of our anguish, help. Is there another way? Can you get me out of this? I mean, I know that feeling. I know you know that feeling too. Can you get me out of this? Is there another way? I don't want to have to do this this way. And basically, God's answer to that is no. You, to Jesus, no. If you're going to be fully human, you need to experience what humans experience. And part of being fully human is suffering and death. And you have to go through it. There is no way around this. You have to go through it. And I think that's a message maybe we can kind of move this to an end with, is that that's true for us too. There's no escaping suffering in this life. There's no escaping death. Mom was telling me this morning of a woman that we know who just died of the COVID-19 virus. So did her mother before her and her sister before her. And don't you know, when she was in those moments, she knew. And what was she wanting? We don't get to escape suffering. We're all seeing that. If we're not seeing that, we're not paying attention. Suffering is a part of life. And death is a part of life. And one of the things this COVID-19 has reminded me of, and Mom and I were talking about that yesterday on our walk, that we're going to die. And we could die at any time. And I'm not meaning to be morbid about it. We could. And this is our Garden of Gethsemane moment for a lot of people. You know, this is a Garden of Gethsemane moment. And so I find the Garden of Gethsemane and Jesus still even then saying, can't we do this other way? Can't we do it with the thrones? Can't we do it that way? And he knows it. He knows what's happening. He seems to know what's happening. He's a pretty astute guy, pretty smart guy. He knows what's happening. He knows what's to come. And, you know, the fact that he's rather not is comforting to me, because I'd rather not face suffering and death either. But the fact is, I'm going to have to.
Yeah, I might suggest, or at least I've been thinking this way, is just that the profundity of the Christian faith somehow lies in the Garden of Gethsemane and the cross. That's where we have something profound to say to the world. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned for a couple more episodes on Holy Week.